Hello and welcome back to issue 48 of Double Reel, the monthly magazine podcast for the discerning film nerd. My name's James Adamson and I'm here to regale you with nerdy chat about films and the world of cinema generally. I'm joined as always by my co-host, also called James Adamson. Welcome, James.
Hello, it is good to be back.
Last week we brought you the first part, Double Reel Monthly, with news, reviews of new releases and chat about how we're fitting film watching into our busy, exciting lives. If you haven't heard it yet, please do go back and download it, where you'll find reviews of new and recent films, including Ricky Stenicki, Immaculate, The Beekeeper, Roadhouse, and Shamrock Spitfire. We also discussed the latest film in my new year-long project featuring women directors, which was Greta Gerwig's Lady Bird, and the latest film in James's Christopher Nolan project, The Dark Knight. Just to mention again, if you're enjoying the pod, we'd be very grateful if you take a couple of minutes to give us a five-star review wherever you get your podcasts.
Now it's time for our regular features. We start with Classics and Recommended, where we dip into our list of great films we haven't got round to seeing yet. For this issue, it's a film noir masterpiece from Orson Welles, Touch of Evil.
Our hidden gem looks at lesser-known or underappreciated films that deserve a wider audience, which this month features the millennial cult classic Ghost Dog, The Way of the Samurai.
Then it's The One That Got Away, where we look at projects that filmmakers tried and failed to bring to the big screen. This time we look at Martin Scorsese's attempt to tell the story of House of Gucci almost two decades before Ridley Scott's version came out.
We close our features episode with the remake Hate Watch. This month we look at the 1977 attempt to cash in on the Jaws phenomenon with a different giant sea creature, Orca.
Next week it's The Big Conversation, where we discuss a topic from the film world in more detail. We'll tell you more about that a bit later.
First, we've got some messages from listeners about this month's features. Our classic is Touch of Evil, and Gary says, superbly directed by Orson Welles, it's cutting edge for the time, as well as dealing with tougher subject matter, considering what 50s audiences were used to. It's weird seeing Charlton Heston as a Mexican, but without his involvement, the film would never have been made. Stephanie agrees, great movie, lucky enough to see it on the big screen at a rep cinema. You lucky thing. Lauren agrees about Heston as a Mexican character. I'd have liked to have seen Heston as the corrupt cop and cast an actual Latino actor in the Ramon role like Jose Ferrer or Anthony Quinn. Hidden gem is Ghost Dog, and Aggie says one of my all-time favourites, amazing soundtrack as well. Sean says on my list of most underrated films of all time, I love how it shows the softer, more contemplative side of a ruthless character. Marie says this really is a hidden gem. I've never actually heard of this film until he stuck it up on the socials. Our One That Got Away is Scorsese's House of Gucci, and Alison says, not sure what Scorsese would have done with that story, but I'd take any version that didn't have Jared Leto. He completely ruined that movie. Liam says, I kind of like Ridley Scott's House of Gucci in a so bad it's good kind of way. Not sure we need Scorsese taking it too seriously. Our roommate Hate watches Orca, and Andre says, I thought this was more than just a Jaws ripoff. It is an environmental message, and you identify with the orca and realise how misunderstood creatures they are. The action's a bit underwhelming compared to Jaws, but it has good moments and Richard Harris manages to make a somewhat harsh character sympathetic. Sean also defending it, saying, I thought it was a great film. It's a revenge story from the point of view of the orca, and the scene with the baby whale traumatised me. Later on, we're also going to discuss how we'd like to see a remake of Tron Legacy, and Rishi, not that one, says, I don't know why this got a bad reception at the time. I loved it. Really moved the story on from the first film, especially the visual effects and developing the world of the grid. Corey follows up regarding the Tron Ares sequel, which we're probably going to touch on as well. It's a shame Tron Legacy didn't do well. We might have got the next sequel a lot sooner. It seems a little too late now. And Dallin says, I'd rather see it rebooted as a Disney Plus series, taking in the events of the first film, the animated series Uprising, and then closing with the events of Legacy. This time I'd like to see them get more into the detail of the world of Legacy because it was too thin in the film. Then go for a full invasion of our world from the grid. This is from great thoughts here, from the grid as a final season. And Matthias says, neither of the Tron films took the ideas where they should have gone. It spent too much time on a stupid kind of mysticism instead of exploring the technological world they dreamed up. Same problem with the black hole movie. A lot of thoughts about Tron Legacy out there. I think there's like a whole like subculture of, you know, wanting more from that world. But thanks for your messages. It's always great to hear from you. Now on with the pod. Now for the Classics and Recommended feature, where we try and watch something from our backlog of great films instead of the endless movie repeats rotating on TV. Our watch list includes films one or both of us hasn't seen before and recommendations from you, the audience. Committing to do so for the feature has helped break the mental block around some of those films. I mean, we got to see and share our thoughts on a wide range of films, from Sam Peckinpah's controversial Straw Dogs to mind-bending anime Paprika. We have a growing list of other films to do for this feature as we keep adding films we haven't seen yet and from the steady stream of audience recommendations. You can go to letterboxd.com/doublereel and click watch list for all the films on our list, and you can make recommendations there or on all the usual places on our socials. This month we look at a 50s crime drama from a pioneering maverick auteur where neither the film nor its director were truly appreciated in their own time. The classics and recommended feature for issue 48 is the Orson Welles film noir Touch of Evil. So James, presumably you hadn't seen this before.
No.
Had you heard much about it? I know we talked about it when we did the player for this feature, because the tracking shot at the start of the player is inspired by the start of this movie. But I mean, what had you sort of heard about Touch of Evil or found out about it, you know, in the build up to watching it?
So obviously I had no idea, and then did a bit of reading just to kind of get a bit of a gist of the story without spoiling it too much. I was sort of surprised when I read the first sort of, not tagline, but it's obviously a car bomb on the American side of, you know, a border.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, okay, this is interesting for a film that came out, you know, 70-odd, you know, years ago, thereabouts. Yeah. And yeah, I thought, right, I'll go from there. I won't read anymore and we'll just watch it.
Okay, interesting. Yeah, because we also talked about Orson Welles a few times. His career is kind of this legendary, you know, he's the, I think I used this analogy when we were doing the one, A One That Got Away featuring him. He's one of the, he's the equivalent of like a wayward talent in football where, you know, half the discussion is about what he did and half the discussion is about what he might have done if things had been different, you know. And people generally see that, you know, he had this, you know, incredible start with Citizen Kane and everything was kind of downhill from there. This is one of the other films that he did, which was a commercial failure when it came out, but is, you know, regarded as an all-time classic movie. I found this a little bit strange. Maybe one of the reasons I haven't watched this. One, Charlton Heston is a Mexican. I found that a bit of a weird concept. And two, it's a film noir, but from the late 50s. This is from like 1958, I think, 58, 59. And I always think of film noir as being like the 1940s, like when we did The Big Sleep and that. I mean, what decade of film noir do you normally think of? When someone says it's a film noir, what's normally in your head in terms of when that is and where that is?
Earlier than this, for sure. But it's obviously, it's quite a long period, I suppose. I suppose I would consider this towards the end of the probably the film noir.
Yeah.
Probably from like the 30s, I reckon. But
yeah.
There'll have been film noirs in the 20s and 40s as well. Sure.
Yeah, I mean, I think generally speaking, film noir is the absolute kind of centre of it. It's like when you talk about, you know, generations. I mean, you know how like you're somewhere between a millennial and Gen Z, but you're not a millennial and you're too young to be a millennial and you're kind of too old to be Gen Z as well because you're on the cusp. But there's a centre of the era of film noir, which is probably like the mid to late 40s when a lot of that was happening and like every film was a film noir. This is very much late on. And like you say, a car bomb on the Mexican border, that's, it's you know, potentially controversial. It's darker subject matter than normal. It's, you know, the sort of things that would make headlines in a newspaper if it happened. It's quite different stuff, isn't it?
Yeah. That's a storyline that could be fucking used today. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. In fact, the whole storyline could be today, couldn't it? It would be a different. You wouldn't make a film noir. You might make a neo noir, but you could make some sort of like border, modern day. You could almost do it like a modern day western. You know, like on the border of Mexico and California. You know, the way you did where they did Hell and High Water, which is, I know is Texas. But you know, there's a number of different styles you could do for a story like that. So a bit of background, like James says, the opening incident is a car bomb goes off, killing. It's on the border between Mexico and USA, which from the way it's portrayed at the start of the film, it feels like it's a border that people are just constantly going backwards and forwards across, doesn't it, mate?
Yeah.
And people seem to have lives on both sides of the border, and this guy is like seems to be quite a big businessman or something in America, but he has interest in Mexico. He was over in Mexico, driving back from Mexico. Car bomb goes off, killing him. Orson Welles as a really grotesque, like corrupt but influential cop. Well, you say he's corrupt, but he's a dirty cop. And he's you know, almost like, but he feels like he's not really any dirtier than anyone else back then. But he's like a real kind of, you know, big character. He reminded me a little bit of the guy out of The Shield. He's investigating. Charlton Heston's character is a Mexican policeman who's a bit of a crusader against the drug cartels. Again, this stuff could be a, you know, story you could write today. who has an American wife and is going backwards and forwards across the border. He witnesses the bombing, so he takes an interest in it. There's an argument over whether the person they arrest really did it. That gets into a downward spiral of, you know, someone being fitted up. Charlton Heston's Mexican character, Ramon, and Orson Welles' like sheriff character basically go toe-to-toe in this shady border town. Organised crime gets involved. It gets pretty dark, actually, stuff that goes on. Janet Leigh plays Ramon's wife. And again, the opening, with all Orson Welles films, especially his early stuff, there's often a discussion of the technique. You know, there's all sorts of things in Citizen Kane which people rave about. And 80 years later, you're like, well, that's just how people make movies. Do you know what I mean? But it must have been pioneering then. There's always this conversation about Orson Welles. But that tracking shot was a big deal, and a lot of people talk about it. You know, Robert Altman made a point of trying to match or even exceed that tracking shot at the start of The Player. When we talked about Sergio Leone's Leningrad film, he wanted to do a tracking shot like this. This is a milestone in many ways. What did you think of the opening of the movie? Because it's not just about technique, it's about the storytelling. What did you think of that opening?
I found it quite tense, you know, like, in a weird way, because I'd obviously read the tagline, so I knew a car bomb was coming, I just didn't know when. And I wondered if, you know, say you've just decided, oh, we'll go see the new Orson Welles film, you don't know anything about it, you would have no idea that it's coming. But because I knew it was coming, I was like, when's this going to happen? And I hate stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's my own fault because I read about the film.
Like, but, you know, that's the thing. I mean, Hitchcock said that this suspense isn't a bomb going off. Suspense is waiting for a bomb to go off, you know?
Yeah.
And, yeah, that the other thing about the tracking shot is that it also, you see Orson Welles, you see a bit of Orson Welles as the cop, but you see a lot of Charlton Heston and his and Janet Leigh as the married couple walking across the border from Mexico back to the US, or are they walking back from the US? But you also see the car parked, you see someone put the bomb in the car, but you don't see who it is. You see a lot of the different characters that are going to show up in the story sort of walk in and out of the frame, and you see the border, you see how close the US and Mexico are. And so as well as knowing the bomb's going off, you really get like a picture of like the setting that the film's going to take place in, don't you? There's a lot of storytelling in there, isn't there?
Yeah, yeah.
So, what did you think of the setup of the story? You know, there's a car bomb, we don't know who done it, and then it starts to play out. What were your feelings as that film unfolded like that?
Yeah, they obviously start hinting that it might be a sort of cartel, sort of like drug gang thing. Mm-hmm. And it's all about Orson Welles, the sort of like captain of the local police, or like detective, going about trying to investigate it, and he's sort of not interested, but then he sort of gets persuaded by the sergeant, and they sort of just start investigating, and it sort of uncovers the kind of dark, shady stuff going on from there. And yeah, I quite liked it. I'm not the biggest fan of Orson Welles, I have to admit. I think Citizen Kane's a pile of shite, but this was much better. It was actually an interesting sort of story, and I found it, obviously it's of its time and it's dated, and if they did it today there'd be lots of like chases and, you know, gunfights, that, you know, like super action, you know, scenes. But yeah, I quite liked it. I found it quite investigative, you know, as opposed to, you know, obviously they were limited with what they could do back then, but yeah, I quite liked it.
Yeah, I mean, the subject matter, I mean, we talked already about how the storyline could be today, but a lot of the themes of the film, I think, would have been quite modern for the time, because it is interested in, you know, racism against Mexicans by American people. You know, just fundamentally, there seems to be this discomfort for the Ramon character about the fact that his wife is American and white, and he's Latino and Mexican, and that's a struggle. The Quinlan, the police captain that Orson Welles plays, he's a, you know, anti-Mexican bigot. There's, you know, it's almost like, yeah, we'll just round someone up for this. It talks very openly about alcoholism and drug addiction and corruption, and, you know, we take that for granted, right? But that would have been, I think maybe sometimes we overestimate how like massively kind of, you know, innocent everybody was back then. They weren't that innocent. They were aware of bad stuff happening, but I don't think they were aware of being confronted by it like this in a movie, were they?
No, not at all.
Were you There's a couple of different versions of this. I assume, I don't know if you even remember, there's a 108-minute cut of this film and like a 95 or 98-minute cut of this film. I assume you watched the normal one, the 98-minute cut?
Yes, I think so.
As is always the case with Orson Welles films, he falls out with the studio. We had Final Cut taken off him. They forced reshoots. So I think his talent and the way he shot the film meant that a lot of what he wanted to do showed through. But there is like a mythical 108-minute cut, which apparently tells you more. I haven't seen that. And sometimes in those cases, the shorter film is tighter and, you know, sometimes keeping the pressure up and keeping the tension up is easier if you don't have a longer running time, right?
Yeah.
What did you think of Charlton Heston in his role?
Yeah, I mean, I've always found Charlton Heston to be quite good value, yeah. I think he was a very good choice for the sort of lead, because it is an Orson Welles film. You're never really the lead in that film, but yeah, I thought he was good. I thought he was a solid performance.
Yeah, I mean, a bit of background to this. The film got made because Charlton Heston wanted to do it. He read the script and was well up for it. Orson Welles got the job directing the film because Charlton Heston was a fan of his and said, I think Orson Welles is really good. We should get him to direct the film.
Right.
So, like the listener message, Charlton Heston's absolutely critical to this film getting made. And you're right, it's sort of an ideal role for him, that kind of crusading cop, isn't it? And he gets forced into, because, you know, things happen to his wife, I don't want to spoil the plot too much, organised crime and corrupt cops and various things happen. He's not sure how much truth to tell. He's worried about his reputation being destroyed. He's worried that maybe the cartels want him or his family dead because he's taken on the cartels. But he's fundamentally, he's like the crusading, you know, he has to fight dirty, or he has to kind of, you know, go to the mattresses, as it were, to kind of take on his antagonist in this film. But at the starting point, he's that kind of upstanding crusading guy that you always know Charlton Heston to be, right? What would you think, though, of the fact that originally Charlton Heston wanted to play the corrupt cop? What would you think of him playing the other part?
I don't know how that would have worked out.
Because, you know, actors always want to do that. They always want to do the other part. They always want to do the part they're not used to playing, yeah. Right? But what do you think that would have been like with him?
I think because we're just so used to him being the sort of, like, hero, it would have been a difficult, I suppose, job for him to kind of get us to not see it like that. Do you not see him like that?
Mm-hmm.
I don't doubt that he could have done it, but I think he worked better as like the kind of good cop.
Yeah, I get what you're saying. The challenge you've got, obviously, is that the good cop in this story is Mexican. So Charlton Heston as a Mexican just feels weird to a modern audience, right?
Yeah.
How long did it take you to get past that?
I tried not to look into it too much. I mean, there's definitely, you know, there's definitely worse things that have been done in films. See Laurence Olivier playing Othello, but
yeah.
You just kind of got to not see into it too much. You know, it was the 50s. They didn't have actors like, you know, Diego Luna and Pedro Pascal back then, who are, you know, sort of American to do that kind of thing. So I didn't look into it too much.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, Charlton Heston's the reason this film's getting made. So, and the other thing is, right, is that Orson Welles substantially rewrote this script. It was originally called Badge of Evil. He changed the name and he rewrote it substantially. So they could have adjusted the part slightly so that Orson, that Charlton Heston had some other part, and they did get a Mexican actor. As I said, Latino actors, one of the listeners actually called them out. Latino actors at the time who could have played a part were Jose Ferrer, who had already won a Best Actor Oscar by then, and Anthony Quinn. They could have played a Mexican if they really wanted to. But, you know how this goes. This film's only getting made because of Charlton Heston, who's a really big star in the late 50s. There's some things about this film that are quite modern compared to a film back then. There's lots of close-ups of Orson Welles at his most grotesque. And he wasn't as big and fat in that in real life. He was actually wearing a fat suit and stuff, and age makeup for then. Because he's still only in his, like, he's still maybe 40. He's maybe basically just 40 when he's making this film, maybe.
Right.
But there's lots of close-ups of him looking grotesque. There's lots of things that you wouldn't get as much of back then, you know, someone being held down and forced to take drugs and kidnapped, you know, women in danger from the cartels. It's tough stuff. At the same time, though, the 50s is the 50s and people act a certain way. The censors allow certain things to pass. What did you think about that potential stylistic clash of Orson Welles wanting to do tougher, more modern material and the conventions of a 1950s film?
I suppose it's different for us, you know, because we're watching it from a totally different time period. I imagine it would have been quite jarring back in 1958, but I didn't have any problems with it, did you?
No, I think it's interesting when you see a film like that, you know what I mean? You can see the, like, a more modern style of filmmaking busting to get out, you know?
Yeah.
And people like him push the boundaries. The 60s happened because of what people did in the 50s, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was interesting. Again, and it's always interesting to go back and go, because you know what it's like? Because remember, we've talked a lot about 1971 being this big watershed for film, haven't we? Because we've talked about Dirty Harry and Straw Dogs and The French Connection and various other films that come out in 1970, like Clockwork Orange. And the early 70s like that is this big watershed, and films look a little bit more modern after that. Action looks more modern. People, you know, people seem to be more willing to confront gory and dark stuff after that time. Yeah. It's always interesting to go back to like 1958 and go, actually, you know what? People were confronting stuff in the way that they could back then as well, you know?
Yeah, it's interesting, actually.
Yeah, I mean, the other, there's a couple of sort of bits of trivia to it. Marlene Dietrich makes an uncredited response.
Yeah, I saw that.
I mean, I suppose that's, I mean, that's partly because friends of Orson Welles turn up to make the movies and stuff, but also I think there was an element of this Mexican town. It's, I think they're trying to create this like international border town thing to it. A lot of people seem to have pitched up on that town because they've got nowhere else to go, or they've got a past and they end up there. What did you think of the atmosphere of that, of that kind of border town thing? It reminded me a bit of Casablanca, but what did you think of that border town world?
Yeah, I quite liked it. It seemed very sort of like, maybe rundown's the right word for it. Like, just sort of, it felt quite clammy. Do you know what I mean? Mm. Like, it really kind of gave off that sense of...
It's a real atmosphere to it, wasn't it?
Yeah, the environment of it all.
Yeah, definitely. In terms of action, there's one thing that I always think, especially about Orson Welles films, because he was definitely one of these people who wanted to be more and more modern and very pioneering, and then you watch his film 65 years later and there's that kind of tension. How was the ending for you? Some of that is... I still have a problem personally with films from the 40s and 50s when people get shot and there's that rather tame... They sort of hold the small of their back for a second and then sort of crumple gently to the floor and that sort of thing. What did you think of this ending? You know, there's this extended kind of battle. People have been dragged through a lake. You know, this extended tension. What did you think of that kind of climax and the way it played out?
Yeah, it was gritty, I thought.
Grittier?
Very gritty, yeah.
Grittier than a lot of things I've seen in the 1950s.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. I have to say I enjoyed this film. I think it's the kind of thing... I think a lot of films from this era wouldn't stand up or age as well as this. I thought this held up pretty well.
No, I think so too. It was, unfortunately, I do think it'll be one that we'll talk about in the future as like a remake Hate Watch, do you know?
You think someone's going to make this?
Yeah, I worry about that just because of the kind of the subject matter of it.
Yeah, I mean... The only thing I'd say about this, I think it's the sort of thing where, not necessarily to remake, but if someone was to tell another story about political corruption and murky dealings and that intersection of the US and Mexico in a border town with cops and gangsters, if someone wanted to go back to that well but tell their own story, I'd be well up for that, but not a straight remake, right?
No, definitely not.
Definitely not, yeah, I mean... You think people would be? I know you're not a big fan of Citizen Kane. I do actually really like it as a film, but I do appreciate it's hard to reconcile what something that pioneering from 80 years ago. But you just think people, there's certain films people should just leave alone, right?
Yeah,
definitely. Okay. One last bit of nerdiness. There is a scene with basic sort of hoodlums, sort of the Mexican gangsters. With all their 50s like pompadour hairstyles and leather jackets threatening people. Did you recognise one of them was actually a woman playing a young man?
I did, yes. But they played it off very well.
Did you know who that was?
No.
That was Mercedes McCambridge, who's not Mexican either. We'll have to kind of, like I said, we have to look past that a little bit. And she was part of the Mercury Theatre troupe where Orson Welles started out. So they knew each other, they were friends. So he got her in to do it. She is famous for doing the voice of the demon in The Exorcist.
Oh.
And that's Mercedes McCambridge, if you want to see what she actually looks like in a movie. But yeah, this is Orson Welles. It's another one where it didn't do very well at the box office at the time, but it was better received in Europe than it was in America. The same story about Orson Welles over and over again. It's recognised now as a classic, and that tracking shot at the beginning is a really incredible piece of technique. And as James pointed out, clammy atmosphere and like very tense and gritty ending. This is a decent piece of film noir cinema by anyone's standards, I reckon. And I think we're giving this a thumbs up. This is definitely a classic that it was worth getting around to watch. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
And now for the hidden gem feature about a film that is not as well known or as appreciated as it deserves to be. We aim to bring an overlooked and underrated film to your attention and say why this deserved to have more critical and commercial success than it got and why you should watch it or reevaluate it. This month we look at a cult film from the end of the 90s which provided a quirky indie spin on a classic Hitman story. The hidden gem for issue 47 is Ghost Dog, The Way of the Samurai. So James, I'm going to bet you hadn't really even heard of this film before I suggested it from the list of hidden gems?
No, I hadn't.
What about Jim Jarmusch, the director? Is that a name that's popped up for you?
No.
He recently did a film which you're almost guaranteed not to like, called The Dead Don't Die with Adam Driver. It was kind of a quirky spoof of zombie films and stuff. No one liked it very much, really, but he's an indie director. He's always off doing slightly strange things, but he loves the vibes. He loves a good movie soundtrack. And this is very heavily influenced by a film called Le Samurai, which is a French like police thriller, crime thriller, by Jean-Pierre Melville, which is a really tough, laconic crime film, probably more serious in tone than this. But Jim Jarmusch was really heavily influenced by that, and this is dipping into this kind of almost mythological kind of view of. You know, the hitman that you have in the assassin hitman character that you have in films that almost certainly doesn't exist in real life, right? Real life hitman characters are like Michael Shannon in that, the Iceman, and hitman characters in movies are something completely different. But this is from that that kind of tradition. I mean, it's a subgenre I like. I know it's not everyone's cup of tea. Where are you with those hitman type films? Character studies of assassins who are basically killing people for money.
They're okay. Like, it's not really my thing. I don't know, I just feel like it's quite a tired genre. I know it's an older film, but...
Yeah, I mean, at their best, it's kind of it's a vehicle for someone to tell various different kinds of story. Like, Gross Point Blank is nominally a hitman, but it's basically a rom-com about someone who goes back to his high school reunion. And the fact that he's a hitman drives the story, but you get so many other things in the story, that's really fresh.
Yeah.
Also think it's been heavily overused by Luc Besson. He's basically done 15 versions of Nikita now, like Anna and all these things. And it's like a month can't go by without a new Netflix movie about a hitman or a hitwoman like Kate or that. There was that one with Jessica Chastain. You're right, it has been overdone. This is from about 25 years ago. The reason it's a hidden gem was that it was filmed by Jim Jarmusch in 1999. It wasn't released until the year 2000. Sort of, it went to festivals and then looked for a distributor, very small scale, $2 million budget, $9 million at the box office. So it made money, but it wasn't seen by a lot of people. And I think the word quirky does kind of come into play here. What did you sort of read the write-up of it, or did you just stick it on and see?
Yeah, I read the tag, like the kind of brief description on IMDb and thought, okay, this sounds a bit odd, but I'll give it a chance anyway for the pod. And yeah, just went from there, really.
I mean, so by way of a sort of a description, the background of this, the central character is a very sort of solitary sort of young black guy who lives in the inner cities of an unnamed America city. You know, judging by the cops, it could be like New Jersey, not the cops, by the gangsters that he hangs or he makes contact with, it could be somewhere like New Jersey, but it doesn't actually name the city that he's in. In his past, he was, as a young man or as even as a boy, he was saved from being beaten to death or killed by a one of these classic New Jersey gangsters, the guys you'd see sort of turning up in a cafe in The Sopranos and getting a job and going off and doing it, mid-level guy, right? And he feels like he owes his life to this like mafioso. So he goes to work for him and eventually becomes a hitman killing people for this guy. And he sees himself as a samurai. He reads a book about the samurai code. And you often get voiceover through the film of him reading passages from the samurai code. That's how he lives his life. He basically feels like he owes his life to, you know, this person, and he's going to live by code and do his job, you know, for them. And he sees himself as a samurai so much that he has a samurai sword and he practices. Some interesting quirks to him that he kind of lives on the roof lives near the roof of an apartment building, and he keeps messenger pigeons, and that's the only way to communicate with him, which makes him very secure. No one but the one mafioso guy knows what he looks like. He's instructed to carry out a hit basically on a man who's seduced the daughter of the mafia boss. He's trying to get the daughter to come back and not run away with this, you know, deadbeat who's tried to take his daughter away. It goes a little bit awry, not quite awry, but it doesn't quite go as planned. And the mafioso guy says, well, you know, even though I wanted him dead, he's a made guy. So this assassin has to be killed for it. Otherwise, there's going to be trouble. So now the people he works for are trying to kill him. And that kind of conflicts with his code, because the people he feels loyalty to are trying to kill him. What does he do about that? So far, so normal, but it's kind of strange in that sense. The first thing that's a bit strange about it is that Forrest Whitaker plays the hitman, and I've never thought of him as having a samurai vibe. I always more thought of him as having a big cuddly bear vibe. What did you think of him in the main role?
I sort of had that view of him as well. Not that he can't play absolute fucking psychopath. He won an Oscar for it. But yeah, he does kind of have that kind of, just that sort of like build, doesn't it, of like a kind of softer figure.
Mm. I mean, less so now, but certainly back then he was just, you know, he was a big bear of a man, wasn't he?
Yeah. So yeah, I didn't really have any issues with his appearance, because you know, you can,
you just got to get on with it, haven't you?
Sort of. Yeah. That's,
and obviously his voice is wonderful. So when he's reading out these kind of passages from the samurai in voiceover, that's really atmospheric and really like that. I'm still not sure, though, how seriously I was meant to be taking this film. I mean, how serious was this film for you? Because some of it comes across as a bit spoofy and weird with the mafia guys, because they're all a bit paunchy, they're all a bit past it. They talk about sort of strange things in conversation sometimes. How seriously did you think we were meant to take this story while we're watching it? Because there's one point where the mafia boss just does an elk impression for absolutely no reason.
Yeah. I did find those kind of elements of it a bit odd, and I felt sort of like distracted from the sort of storyline of, you know, what Forrest Whitaker's there for. And obviously the whole point is that a job goes wrong and the kind of mob are, you know, after him, but I don't think they depicted the mob very well in this. I found it a bit daft.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of like the way that all the sort of the New Jersey style mafia gangsters are all a bit old and schlubby, because there was an element of these guys they're probably on their way out. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think part of the story is that their grip on power is starting to come to an end. There's going to be a bit of a changing of the guard, and I thought that was an interesting time. There's a lot of things I liked about Forrest Whitaker's character, because again, he's quite solitary. He drives through the night. He does those voiceovers. Terrific hip-hop soundtrack that, you know, evokes the late 90s very well, and lots of little tributes to The Samurai, which is a great film that I like. In the Samurai, Alain Delon, who plays the hitman, he has a set of keys which can get him, he can basically break into and drive away any Citroën in Paris, because he's got this ring of keys. And what Forrest Whitaker's got in as Ghost Dog, what Ghost Dog's got in the movie is sort of like an electrical device which helps him to like hotwire any car, and it means he can just, you know, in and out, disappear. No one sees him there. And I did like the idea of him being a little bit lonely, having some strange friendships with the people that he meets, and contrasting that with the fact that he's got to be a ruthless killer. There's a lot of things I liked about it, but there were a couple of times when I just went, quite quirky now. Not sure how quirky it needed to be, you know?
Yeah.
What about, did you like the mood, though? I mean, you know, when he's driving through the night and you've got, you know, RZA or various other things on the soundtrack, what did you, I mean, did you like that bit?
Yeah, it was okay. I felt like the story was not lacking, but I wanted a bit more of it. I feel like it got caught up in other elements like that. But that's just sort of like, sort of me. That's how I felt about it.
So in terms of the narrative, that, because again, there's a lot of vibes in this. So I think perhaps you would have enjoyed less of the sort of that sort of thing, slowing things up, and more of the twists and turns of the people are trying to kill him. What's he going to do about that? You know, he's got a, you know, the conflict between the loyalty to at least one of the mafiosos and the other ones. And does he fight? Does he not? And all that sort of thing. You would have liked to have seen more of the kind of plot play out in that way. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's got quite a languid pace, which I enjoyed. It meant that when violence does break out, it's a bit of a shock, which I quite enjoyed. I think this is very... It's a cult movie. And the whole thing about a cult movie is that some people are going to be up for it and some people aren't they? I mean, what sort of films regarded as cult films would you say that you were a big fan of?
Oh, you've put me on the spot. Why don't you go first?
in terms of cult movies, I like this. I mean, we're probably going to be doing a discussion of like Withnell and I, you know, later in the pod. I mean, The Big Lebowski is a cult film. Let's just say, yeah. The Big Lebowski is a cult film, and it's almost like, when I watch The Big Lebowski, if I put it on, I kind of just say to my wife, look, you're not going to enjoy this. Do you know what I mean? Because I'm going to start laughing at the jokes like half a minute before they happen, because I've seen this film so many times. And she's like, yeah, I'll go make a cup of tea or something. Do you know what I mean? It's like a cult movie, has its own little fandom, like the Rocky Horror Picture Show. When they put that on, people dress up and they shout at the screen. Do you know what I mean? Like, cult films have that element to them. And it means that they'll have a lot of people who just, that's not for me. And then a small number of people who are like, I love everything about this. Do you know what I mean? This is definitely one of those. This is a cult movie for people who like Hitman films and don't mind things a bit quirky, which worked for me, but I could see why it wouldn't be for everyone, which is why it's a cult classic, you know?
Yeah. I didn't hate that too much. I mean, if we're talking about the greatest cult film of all time, we're probably talking Hot Fuzz.
Because it's just... It's like, because, you know, when it comes on the telly, you go, oh, I know where we are, and I could probably recite all the dialogue from this. Do you know what I mean? You go, oh, the greater good, and you throw in like lines from I don't want to be Judge Judy and Executioner into conversations that have nothing to do with the film, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's, it's one of those. I think it's a big influence on films like The American with George Clooney and The Killer, David Fincher's latest film. I think it's better than The Killer. I think The Killer didn't quite work. It's got a really cool atmosphere. It's got a really cool kind of late 90s hip hop soundtrack, which I think you'd appreciate. I think Forest Whitaker is great in this film, and I think he's a very enigmatic figure because of his samurai code. That's why the original film The Samurai worked, because it's like someone who's just an assassin who kills people for money, he's a piece of shit. Do you know what I mean? The next person he kills could be an honest person who's a witness to a crime and gets killed, and, you know, their family orphaned. So in real life, this isn't a nice character. Do you know what I mean? But in the world of the film, the idea of a samurai going, look, I owe this person my life, I'm going to do my duty by, you know, and be a samurai and kill one I need to kill. It's a way of telling that story, you know? And I think it works on that. So, glad you watched it.
Yeah, it was a perfectly decent watch for a couple of hours, for sure.
Yeah, and it's just like we say, the ethos of this film is, we love to have a nice sort of film chat, and we like to think that when people listen in, the films that we mentioned, what have I just mentioned? The Killer, The Samurai, The Big Lebowski, you talked about Hot Fuzz. We'll talk about a bunch of films, and what we want to do is have somebody listening going, oh, I've not seen that, I might give it a go. That's the whole ethos of this one, and I think... I hope that someone out there gives this film a go as a result of us talking about it. But yeah, that's our hidden gem for this month. Now for The One That Got Away, where we dig deeper into cinematic history for stories of potentially great films that top directors tried and failed to bring to the screen. We look at what happened, why it didn't work out, and what it might have been like if they'd been able to realise their vision. This month, we look at what might have happened if, instead of a renowned veteran filmmaker telling the wild true story of murder in high fashion in 2021, a different giant of the cinema had done it almost 20 years earlier. The One That Got Away for issue 48 is Martin Scorsese's House of Gucci. Now, quick announcement here. We mentioned it in the previous episode, Double Real Monthly. We're not going to do these One That Got Aways anymore. I think we've mined it very heavily. I think also when we want to try and do a theme for the podcast, like, you know, an upcoming episode's going to have like a police crime thriller theme. Then I've got to look through the list of like ones that got away for something that fits that theme. And we've done a few where you've gone, I didn't even know this existed. And it's been really hard to research, right?
Yeah.
I think what we can do, though, is, you know, the next time we're talking about a film director, if there's a one that got away that I know about, a film they didn't make, we can always drop into the conversation for 2 minutes. Do you know what I mean? And if, you know, and if you're nerdy and you like that kind of thing, you can always go and have a look. And I do recommend buy yourself a secondhand copy of Tales from Development Hell. The best sci-fi movies never made, both by David Hughes or Simon Braun's The Greatest Movies You'll Never See. They're a fun read for films that never quite happened. But other than that, this is us doing a little One That Got Away. So the background to House of Gucci, I think, will be quite familiar to people, won't it? There was a lot of tension and division in the Gucci fashion house, different factions of the family, different parts of the business battling for control. It culminated in a very headline-grabbing way in the late 90s, in which the wife of Maurizio Gucci conspired to have him murdered. And in 2021, with Lady Gaga and Adam Driver in the lead roles, Ridley Scott made that film. But what I found out was that Martin Scorsese was going to do a film about the conflicts in Gucci in the early 2000s. What did you know about that before I nominated it, or what did you find out once you had a look into it?
I think when we saw the trailer get announced, you mentioned it and said, oh, you kind of recall Martin Scorsese tried to make that film as well.
Yeah.
And I went, oh, okay, interesting. Strange that he didn't get that film made for, you know, whatever reason.
Yeah, what did you find out when you looked it up?
I think sort of, I couldn't find it as definitive, but I think maybe he didn't get maybe the right funding or, you know, schedules. There was a lot of like kind of speculation as to why it didn't get made when I did a little kind of Google search. What about you?
So the background to this is that this is the early 2000s. I think he announced this. I think Gangs of New York is either in the can or has already come out. And he says his next film is going to be... In fact, if I read one of the news stories, I think it's... it's as early as the year 2000. It's like, yeah, when Martin Scorsese finishes Gangs of New York, his next film is going to be about Gucci. And it was based on a book called Gucci, A House Divided. Now, the interesting thing is that book was written in 1987 and talks about decades of division between the different kind of factions in Gucci. By the time in the early 2000s that he's making a movie, that murder has already taken place. The murder trial has already taken place, right? You can't ignore that, can you? You can't make a movie 4 years after the head of Gucci's been murdered and not touch on that in the story, can you? And also the era that it's taken place in is that Scorsese's... He finishes up the 90s with a film called Bringing Out the Dead, which is... I didn't like it very much when it came out. I've heard people say, give it another go. It's underrated. Makes a lot of good points about like the horrific kind of way in which the ambulance service is run in America. He did various different things in the 90s and then went into from Gangs of New York onwards, a bigger, more epic, more historical biographical phase, because it is Gangs of New York, which is sort of based on real events. He then did The Aviator, and this film, House of Gucci, might have replaced The Aviator or happened before it. But again, that's another biographical film about someone in big business, controversial figure, all of that sort of thing. So this is when Scorsese's in that phase, and Leonardo DiCaprio's his go-to guy, because Leonardo DiCaprio gets him $100 million budget and an audience that's going to come and watch the film. So there's every chance that Leo would have been playing a main character in the Gucci story. I think the problem you've got here is that these events are all really, really soon, aren't they? I mean, it was pretty controversial anyway, and the Gucci family weren't happy with Ridley Scott's version. And that's like 20-odd years after the murder happened. What do you think how do you think it would have gone if, like, you're making a story about the murder of Maurizio Gucci, maybe and you start filming 2 years after the trial's finished, what do you think the vibe is in that sort of production?
Maybe, yeah, too soon. Maybe that could have been a factor for it not getting made, but
if you look at the films that Scorsese's making back then, he does what does he do? He does Gangs of New York, he does The Aviator, he does The Departed, you know, all the way through really to maybe Wolf of Wall Street. There's a lot of kind of torn from the headlines films based on true stories back then, isn't there? What sort of, you know, if you look at how he did The Aviator and you look at how he did Gangs of New York, what sort of film does Scorsese make in that era of his career about Gucci, about the story of Gucci? Because we watched that in Ridley Scott's version, and I know the style would have been very different. Ridley Scott's doing some very specific things these days. But what sort of treatment does the Scorsese of the early 2000s give that kind of story?
I think he goes more into the kind of conspiracy side of it, because I felt like in the Ridley Scott one, it was sort of briefly kind of mentioned towards like the kind of final act of the film, but I think there would have been a lot more build up to it, a lot more in the betrayal felt by, I think it's Patricia.
Yeah.
Gucci. I think they would have gone into that a little bit more. They touch on it, obviously, in Ridley Scott's one, and obviously Adam Driver, Maurizio, you know, finds someone new and he leaves her. And they get divorced.
It's a lot more of a personal story, isn't it? In the same way that Napoleon is a very personal story with a lot of the big events, you know, linked to that. The House of Gucci, a lot of it is about the personal kind of family relationships involved, yeah? And the book that he was going to primarily, like, base the film is called Gucci, A House Divided by Gerald McKnight. It's a non-fiction book. And it goes into, like, it's referred to as a full-scale headline-making account of the battle for control of one of Europe's great fortunes and mercantile empires, the House of Gucci. I can see Scorsese doing something like, you know, not in the gangster film kind of sense, but you know when he does these, Scorsese covers logistics and cuts it together. Everything from, like, you know, even recently, Killers of the Flower Moon, Goodfellas, Casino, Wolf of Wall Street. There's almost like a drama documentary with a bit of voiceover to it about, yeah, this happened here. I could almost see him talking about how, here's how they used to make clothes and put them in the shops back then. Here's how the new person wants to do it now. I can almost visualize a Scorsese style montage of playing out the conflict in that way. Do you know what I mean? I could see like the boardroom battle being played out that way. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I think one of the problems that you've got with this, right? I think one of the problems you've got with a film at this time is partly it's the sensitivity around it, isn't it? And I think it's also partly the fact that we don't remember it quite so much this time, but Scorsese had to scrape and battle for every penny of that $97 million budget he got for Gangs of New York. That was really hard going, and only because Leo is such a big star did he get it. So he's really got to kind of fight for that money. And when he does The Aviator in 2004, Howard Hughes has been dead for a while. A lot of the stories of his life are kind of legend. There wasn't really anywhere around going, oh, you can't tell this story about Howard Hughes, it's not on. People have been telling stories about Howard Hughes for years and years. So when you've got those Leo scenes of him sitting there with long fingernails and bottles of his own piss in the room, do you know what I mean? Everybody already knew that. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. And Scorsese, there wasn't going to be blowback for like Scorsese to make that movie. But the Gucci family were going to fucking sue him if he did this story, surely.
I think so, yeah. It was very soon. So I think that might have been why it took so long to get made. And by that point, I think Scorsese just couldn't be bothered with it anymore.
Yeah, I mean, there's some interesting kind of side sort of, you know, connected stories to this is that, you know, after this, if you Google Martin Scorsese Gucci or Martin Scorsese Leonardo DiCaprio Gucci, you get a lot of news articles and a lot of photographs of Martin Scorsese and Leonardo DiCaprio wearing Gucci clothes, standing in front of a Gucci logo, attending a Gucci party at a film festival.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? And also, Gucci have funded a number of his projects, not least the restoration that Scorsese undertook of the movie Once Upon a Time in America, which was Gucci donated money to the foundation so we could do these film restorations. And I almost wonder if Scorsese was interested in telling this story, He might even have been thinking about doing that. Because you know when you announce in the year 2000 you're going to do a film of a book based at Reading in 1987? Scorsese's probably been like kicking that around for years. And it's probably bad timing for Scorsese that in 1998 a murder happens and completely changes that story, right?
Definitely, yeah.
And it's almost like, oh, I still want to tell the story of Gucci. It's so fascinating. And almost its element of it can't be done. It can't be done at that time. And maybe, I'm not saying he was bribed out of doing it, but he probably spoke to the Gucci family and he probably agreed, you know what, this probably isn't the right time. And as a result, they don't do it. But in the end, he sort of, you know, and the Gucci family are allowed to kind of continue existing. And, you know, it's not their fault that shit happened in their past, right? So I don't think there's any element of the Gucci sort of, you know, twisted his arm, talked him out of it, or said, we'll donate to your foundation if you don't make the film. I just think it's probably just a buildup of, I'm not sure I want to, do I want to be in a 3-year legal battle with Gucci over this when it's kind of, especially for a filmmaker of his stature doing, normally when you make a film about a murder that's just happened, that's like a TV movie torn from the headlines, do you know what I mean? Yeah. And Scorsese doing it like only so shortly afterwards, it's just such a different vibe for him. So it probably couldn't have happened back then. I mean, how do you think his telling of the story would have differed from Ridley Scott's, though? What sort of version would he tell?
Yeah, like I sort of touched on briefly, I think it would have focused more on the sort of like betrayal side of it and the feeling of his ex-wife as opposed to the way it was portrayed in the film. I felt like it did focus a lot on like kind of selling the brand off and introducing Tom Ford and things like that. And I don't think Scorsese would have been interested in any of that.
You're thinking like the personal betrayals and battles between like De Niro and Joe Pesci in Casino, you know, the way their rivalry progressed and spiraled out of control.
I think it would definitely focus more on Maurizio's sort of alleged infidelity and that divorce and sort of heartbreak that was for Patrizia Gucci, and then what drove her to do that. I think it would focus a lot more on that because it did sort of feel in the Ridley Scott one that it was very quick. It was like, oh, he's left me. And then it felt like not really much development went into that.
Yeah, it became almost the story of her ambition. Her ambition snowballs and snowballs. That became the story, didn't it?
And I think, although he was very funny, I don't think there would have been as much focus on the character played by Jared Leto.
No.
I don't think he might have been in it as like a sort of like comedy relief and a sort of, you know, they would probably touch on the whole like abandoned or kind of, you know, bought out by Maurizio to get rid of him sort of thing. But he wouldn't have been in it half as much, I don't think, if Scorsese. It would definitely focus much more on the kind of the twisted kind of conspiracy to kind of shoot him.
And you might have got more of the power struggle between the previous generation, the characters that were played by Jeremy Irons and Al Pacino in the film, and that generation and that battle for control of Gucci, because that's 1987, that's going back over a long time. I think you might have got more of the early period.
Yeah, definitely.
Because that's, you know, the principal source novel that Scorsese is going to use is like comes out in 1987 and is going back. I think it goes back to the 60s, so at least the 70s, you know. Very, very different film. Look, it was interesting to listen to. As I say, I've taken a great deal of nerdy pleasure in this. We've got various ones that got away. We started with John Carpenter's Firestarter. We've done some of the big ones like Ridley Scott's Napoleon. Like I say, the future will probably say, like, you know, if we talk about a Lynn Ramsey film, we'll probably mention the fact that she kind of walked off the set of Jane's Got a Gun, and touch on that because it tells you something about the filmmaker. But we're not going to do this anymore. But I hope you've enjoyed listening to these with us and digging down those dark alleys. And as I say, you know, dig out some old books or dig out some old articles about films that didn't get made, because there's some fun stories in there. And I hope you've enjoyed doing them with us. We close the features episode with the remake Hate Watch. This is where we shine a light on the lack of originality in the Hollywood boardroom and their obsession with remaking, rebooting, reimagining, or just plain recycling older films. Quite often, this is our chance to let off steam and rant at a terrible and unworthy remake, which sullies the reputation of an old classic. But every now and again, the new film holds up under our ruthless examination and emerges from the Hate Watch with some credit. Later on, we will also discuss a remake restoration. Once we finished asking if a remake was unnecessary and should be removed, we will suggest a remake that should happen because it needs to be done right this time. This month, we're looking at one of a multitude of films that tried to cash in on the huge success of Steven Spielberg's Jaws. This particular film probably isn't the worst attempt, but none of the others are as unintentionally funny. The remake Hate Watch for issue 48 is the 1977 film Orca. So James, what did you know about the film Orca before I suggested it?
I knew it had been made, but I'd never seen it, just because of how bad all the sequels to the original Jaws were, and that was about a shark, and I thought, okay, they've done the same thing, but with an orca or a killer whale, you know.
Yeah, and it's like all of these things. I mean, Orca is it formally a remake of Jaws? No. Does it exist because Jaws happened? Absolutely. And it's kind of an excuse for me to kind of talk about the Jaws phenomenon, right? Because it was a big thing, right? And just to give you some stuff is that here's what happened to Jaws. Steven Spielberg made Jaws and revolutionized the film industry, right? He invented the modern blockbuster, right? All of a sudden, you have this idea of a big summer movie which makes incredible amounts of money. It's got a high concept. It's got action. Everybody's talking about it. It's got those big popcorn thrown in the air moments. You know, Jaws was made, you know, over 20 years before you were born, but you've watched it. You know about it. And now every summer, people are looking to see what the next big blockbuster is. That's all because of Jaws, right? It absolutely transformed the box office. And here's how it transformed things, right? The top 10 films of the previous year, 1974, the year before Jaws came out. Blazing Saddles. All right, great. Blazing Saddles, a great comedy movie. You will love that. That's not a blockbuster, is it? That's not been designed as a blockbuster. The next movie is an attempt to do a blockbuster, Towering Inferno, the disaster movie. But a year later, Jaws turns out and completely... And, you know, there's a couple of those sorts of blockbuster movies in there. There's Airport 1975, which oddly enough came out in 1974, Earthquake and Towering Inferno. That's what the big sort of attempted blockbuster movie was in 1974. I don't know how many of those films you've seen, mate, but they're incredibly dated. And Jaws just wiped all of those films off the slate, right? Completely different world. And the biggest film of 1974 was a big movie, $119 million at the box office, right? But Jaws made all the fucking money in the world, right? It just made so much money. Jaws makes $260 million domestic in America, 1975. This film's a fucking game changer, right? And the reason I wanted to talk about Orca is this is one of many films that came out around about that time where someone said, okay, a killer shark attacking people in the water, what can we do that's like that? And you had a straight-up rip-off of that called The Last Shark, Italian exploitation that Universal Studios sued, and you can't legally watch that anymore. It's on YouTube, though, if you want to watch it. Piranha, Barracuda, Tentacles about an octopus, Mako the Jaws of Death, which is another big ripoff, Killer Fish, which is a ripoff of Piranha, which was a ripoff of Jaws, Alligator, where an alligator starts attacking people, Grizzly, where a grizzly bear starts attacking people, and even one called Blood Beach. You heard of this?
Nope.
It even ripped off the Jaws 2 tagline, because you know the tagline of Jaws 2 is quite famous just when you thought it was safe to go back in the water.
Yeah.
The tagline for Blood Beach is, just when you thought it was safe to go back in the water, you can't get into it. Why? Because the beach is attacking people.
Oh, fuck's sake.
It's like Ken in the Barbie movie. Beach, yes, just beach. Because the beach is carnivorous and kills people when they go and walk on it. There was this desperate attempt to do anything that would cash in on that. None of these films are anything like as good as Jaws, but when a film like Jaws makes money, there's just going to be this rush to copy it, and that's what happened. Now, Orca comes out in 1977, so it's 100% commissioned and made because of the success of Jaws. It's Dino De Laurentiis, who's responsible for a wide range of films. It's a bit of a character. He's done some very artistic films. He's also done the King Kong remake, which was absolutely terrible. He did Conan the Barbarian, which I love. Real character, this like Italian guy who just believed in films having being lively and showmanship. And the interesting thing about Orca was that he wanted to make the movie, but having said, find me something that's like a shark, and suppose, how about a killer whale? Okay. They then proceeded to do something that had, I think I'd say it had artistic pretensions. I mean, when you read this, did you read the summary of this movie before you watched it? Or did you just go straight in?
Oh, I put it on, but I'm not going to lie, I didn't watch the whole thing. I was just...
They're taking the film very seriously, aren't they? The story is taking very seriously. They've got artistic potentials. The director was nominated for an Oscar for Best Director back in the day, Michael Anderson, not for a very good film, but he's a respected director. Richard Harris in the lead role. Richard Harris is a good actor. Charlotte Rampling, Robert Carradine, Will Sampson from One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. These are like fairly serious actors. At the same time, though, they've got Bo Derek in it. Are you even aware of the Bo Derek phenomenon? And I'm wondering if I'm going to have to try and explain Bo Derek to a young person now.
I have no idea who that is.
So she's the woman who gets her leg broken in the movie. Did you right. watch that far?
Yeah.
Bo Derek became pretty much the biggest star in America because she wore a bikini and was nice looking. And that was enough to be a major star back then. They built a whole film around her called 10, where Dudley Moore, out of Peter Cook and Dudley Moore, wants to have an affair with her. And there's scenes of her running down a beach. And this just... the whole world went completely nuts for Bo Derek. I can't really explain, but if you say Bo Derek to someone over the age of about 50, they go, oh yeah, Bo Derek. And anyone younger than that's going, I've no idea why the fuck that even happened. But she's in it. And a score by Ennio Morricone. Did you notice the music by Ennio Morricone in this?
I did notice that, yeah.
They've really gone for it. Do you think it was wise for them to do a story that they took so seriously?
No, obviously not. It was terrible.
The thing is, it doesn't escape the fate of most other films of this nature. Is the real trick about Jaws is, yes, there's a shark, and yes, that's scary, and yes, people are going to be horrified. The from the opening scene where a shark attack happens, that had a profound effect on people. It scared the shit out of me when I watched it. But the real trick of Jaws is how well made and edited it is, because Steven Spielberg is a fucking master film director. And, you know, the director they got here is like a well-known director, but he's not in this guy's kind of class. But also, it's got these big bits of exposition where Charlotte Rampling is a marine biologist. He's telling you how intelligent orcas are and how complex their culture is. And it's like, you know, making a serious environmental point about capturing orcas for marine parks, which I agree with. I mean, it's interesting. I mean, this predates the Blackfish documentary. I mean, what did you think of the environmental message of the film, though?
Yeah, I guess. But at the same time, you can't really talk about the environmental message when you're trying to kill a fucking animal. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, and that's the thing. I mean, it's weird because essentially the orca is a character in a movie. It kills a shark at the beginning of the film that's about to kill a human, which is... feels like them kind of trying to flex over Jaws to say, you think the great white shark in Jaws is an awesome creature. The orca is more powerful than that. So, well, okay. But then the main character, Richard Harris, he's a fisherman who's trying to catch live orca so he can sell them to a marine park, you know, like SeaWorld or something. Originally, he was trying to catch a great white shark and sell them to a marine park, which kind of predates like one of the Jaws sequels. I don't know how that would have worked. I mean, no one's ever successfully done that. But in real life, orcas do get captured. And it's quite barbaric. And I think people have come around to the idea that these kind of sea park orcas are a terrible thing. And in this one, in his attempt to catch an orca, he fatally wounds a pregnant female. And the male sort of mate or partner of that female orca is... grief-stricken by the loss of his wife and child, so to speak, and swears revenge and keeps coming after Richard Harris and starts attacking the boat in the harbour, starts attacking other boats that come out of that harbour, the whole world. He even manages to start a fire on the ship. I mean, this orca has taken things very personally. And there's a lot of close-ups of the orca's eye seeing Richard Harrison wanting revenge. So like the listener message wrote in, this is a revenge story about an orca that's owed justice, right? Did you sympathise with the orca character?
Yes. The orca is seeking revenge for its murdered mate, so is deciding to kill humans. And given the treatment that humans have given orcas, killer whales, sharks, and every other fucking type of animal that we found in the sea too, right? You're on the side of the orca.
Yeah, I mean, it is one of those films where you can kind of quite happily root for the for it. It's interesting, they've tried very hard to kind of add some like emotional depth to the other characters, like Richard Harris going, Richard Harris at one point says that his wife and child were killed by a drunk driver, so he understands the whale's motivations. It's like, okay. And now he goes out onto a boat and basically fights the orca because that requires the scene. Did you get as far as the end and like the Arctic showdown?
No, I didn't.
Okay, I'm going to spoil the plot for you a little bit.
Oh no! How dare you?
Richard Harris gets killed by orca judo.
Nice.
He gets flicked out of the water by the orca's tail, spun through the air, and smacked against a wall of ice, which kills him.
Ugh.
It's weird. There's this weird balance here because they're trying very hard to take it seriously. Ennio Morricone knows how to write music and atmosphere. Robert Carradine, Charlotte Rampling and Will Sampson are all very good actors. And Richard Harris is a very good actor. And yet, there's something fundamentally silly about the concept of the story. And it's weird to have a serious issue like you talked about, you know, sea creatures being mistreated, being given such a silly storyline. Do you know what I mean? A bit of trivia. Richard Harris insisted on doing his own stunts for the scenes in the North Pole and nearly died on several occasions. Imagine an actor of his stature dying for a film like this. But I mean, the other thing is that they actually used a number of like orcas, like captive orcas, for the filming. Which means in order to shed light, similar to Touch of Evil, where in order to shed light on like racism against Mexicans, they have a film in which a white guy plays a Mexican. In this film, in order to tell a story about the mistreatment of marine animals, they use captive orcas, which we know are not treated all that well, for the filming. You even get the names of the orcas at the end of it. You can Google the orcas that were in this movie and find out what happened to them after this movie. And you know, they're quite well-known whales. So it's kind of strange. But this was a thing back then. I mean, all the films that I talked about, like that were like, you know, starting with Piranha, Grizzly, Alligator, Tentacles, they all came out within about 8 years of the first Jaws film. So this was really, really a thing back then. I mean, is it understandable that people want to try and get in on the action?
Yeah, I do, because It was obviously very popular, but as you listed all those other films, it did just seem to kind of dilute very quickly, didn't it?
I mean, could you see how, I mean, what Steven Spielberg makes Jaws, right? And in the same way that like a successful film gets imitated, it happens over and over again, and often those imitations can be inferior. Was it possible for anybody to do a film even close to Jaws, you know, in that genre? Because I remember the Big Picture is an American podcast that talks about films, and they do themes. And one of their themes was, I think they call it garbage fish or garbage sea creatures. It's just their theme. And it's films about, you know, nature, you know, aquatic creatures battling humans. The problem you've got is that you've got Jaws, which is an all-time great movie, and then a long list of films which are pretty shit. I mean, even Deep Blue Sea, which is a lot of fun, it's basically quite shit, isn't it?
Yeah,
is it possible for someone else to do a movie in this genre that's not just a piece of crap exploitation, or are they all doomed to be just suffer by comparison to the Spielberg original?
Yeah, I think Jaws was that kind of groundbreaking that you could never make a film as good or as popular as that again. Do you know what I mean? Like, there's you can't. It's, you know, it was the peak of that type of film, and it was sort of like it's the most popular film, so you're not going to ever be able to, you know, you don't want to replicate it because, well, plenty of people did replicate it just to try and cash in, but they just made terrible films. But you're not going to be able to kind of use that same genre and take it in a different way because you're just going to get compared to Jaws. Yeah. There's no point.
Yeah. I mean, it's it. I mean, and that's the thing. It's a really interesting, I should be advertising other people's podcasts on here, but it's a really interesting episode of The Big Picture where they talk about all the films, and they talk about Jaws, and they talk about all the other films in this genre. And it's so weird to have it's a subgenre, right? But it's so weird to have a group of films where you've got one good one and the rest of them are nothing like as good. I mean, where are you on Jaws 2, which is basically just a complete retread of the first one? No one else has ever sort of managed to repeat the trick, have they?
No.
Oh, there you go. Lesson learned, probably. But they keep doing it, but they sort of play it for laughs now, things like Sharknado and stuff like that.
Yeah, that's obviously playing into its own ridiculous genre, isn't it? You know, like Ghost Shark and, you know, like Avalanche Shark and all these daft ones.
Yeah, and when they did Snakes on a Plane, the whole idea of it was just that right from the beginning, they're kind of going, look, no one's going to take this seriously, so it's probably better if we don't either. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. So it's very odd to see this very po-faced, serious treatment of the story because, you know, I mean, you don't get Charlotte Rampling in when you want to kind of camp things up and wink at the audience. She's a serious actress, right? And she gives all these speeches in the film about what orcas are like. Their brains are bigger than ours. You know, their communications contain more pieces of information than the Bible. It's funny, this film was on a lot when I was a kid, and I actually remember quite a lot of it. I probably need to double check whether all of my orca knowledge is from this movie and not science. But it's so weird to have that. And then, here comes the orca jumping out of the water, biting someone's leg off. Do you know what I mean? It's like the... I don't think it was ever going to work to take it this seriously. But then if they made the orca a straight baddie like the Great White Shark, that would have been even more grotesque, I suppose. But yeah, they were on a hiding to nothing from the start. Okay. I think it's safe to say we're not kind of endorsing this remake by any stretch, are we?
No.
Our next thing that we're going to do, that we touched on earlier, this is going to feature more prominently and sort of be mentioned a bit better. We're going to tweak the format of the podcast a little bit, bring this part to the fore, because I think we really enjoy this part. This is a redo that I think both of us have been keen to do, mate. I hope you agree. This is a film that didn't quite work the first time, and we're wondering if a remake, you know, remaking it then or remaking it now would be an improvement. It's Tron Legacy. Now, tell me your history, mate, with the film Tron Legacy.
So, we saw it when it came out in the cinema.
About 2010, wasn't it?
Yeah, so I think we enjoyed it, but we were sort of underwhelmed.
Yeah.
That would be a fair description.
Now, you didn't have much history with the original Tron film, did you?
No.
So what? But you are a video gamer. So what was it about Tron Legacy that kind of, when you heard about it, maybe it was me telling you it's about this, but when you heard about the film, what was it about that made you think, oh, I'm going to watch that, that might be good? What was it that drew you in?
I think when you read up about the original Tron story and you go, oh, okay, so he gets trapped in his own video game and he's basically trying to get out, and this is like 30 mm-hmm. years later, and it's following his son, trying to find Jeff Bridges' character, and you go, okay, and then you see Daft Punk on the soundtrack, and it looks, visually, I think it looks okay.
Yeah.
You know, it's...
And that music by Daft Punk, the soundtrack is really good.
The soundtrack is excellent, and it looks interesting, it looks quite polished. It's not the best CGI, and it's not the best visual effects, but it looks good. It looks mm-hmm. very well made. And the thing that just lets it down is the story, more than anything. Mm-hmm. The story's a bit weak, it's a bit bland, it's a bit boring.
Yeah, I mean, I remember seeing the original film Tron, and it came from a kind of a strange little time for Disney. The other film that came out at a similar time, that, funnily enough, a listener message alluded to, was The Black Hole, which was a very expensive sci-fi film that came out in the late 70s, definitely them trying to get in on the Star Wars act. But their science fiction-y type stories back then, their live action, had this very mystical element. And I know the original Tron, it gives you a bit of a headache. I think the graphics are a bit hard to watch now. But it had this kind of mysticism. It had this idea that there's almost like this religious significance to human versus computer interaction, which... it's kind of odd. But I remember being quite interested in the story, finding that interesting. When I thought they're making a sequel, Jeff Bridges is back, all of that. Oh yeah, that sounds good. Let's watch this. And I mean, I own a copy of this on Blu-ray, and I go back to it from time to time. Because I do think there's a good film in there, isn't there? There's a good story trapped inside there somewhere, isn't there?
Yeah, there is, but I don't know how they could use that same story and try and make it better.
Yeah, and I think there are some silly things that they got wrong right at the beginning. like that whole opening scene where Sam, the son of first of all, CGI Jeff Bridges has got to fucking go, right? That was a terrible idea. They didn't have the technology, and it still looks a little bit off now.
Yeah, they still don't have the technology.
It didn't add... It looks far too weird, too pointy, and it didn't really add anything to have a young-looking Jeff Bridges, did it? It didn't add anything to the story. So, that, I mean, and God knows how much that cost them as well. But then the big opening set piece is Sam has to get into the building to hack the system at the start and then base jump off there. And it's like, this is directed by Joseph Kosinski, who I like. I mean, I like Top Gun Maverick, and I thought... I think Oblivion's kind of an underrated sci-fi film. The story's a bit underpowered, but it's well directed. So Joseph Kosinski at the helm of a big sci-fi film, I'm up for. And the base jumping off after he's hacked it and everything. But that should have paid off a bit more. You know, that should have created, like, there's some secrecy and paranoia at Encom, the computer company. Do you know what I mean? Because this guy's breaking in. Do you know what I mean? What that paranoia in the outside world should have been in more in the film. Because once they go into the virtual world, they just forget the world outside. Whereas in the original Tron, there's some stuff going on in the outside world. And it's just it was silly. They didn't really think about the story. It's like, you know, what why is he doing that? Is there more history? Is he in legal battles? Is he being frozen out because he's the son of Kevin Flynn? It was almost just an excuse to have that scene, and then it didn't matter for the rest of the story. Why do they bring in Cillian Murphy to be the son of to play the son of the first movie's villain, who's now basically back in charge of it? They then did nothing with that storyline. I don't know if there was reshoots, but that was just a big loose end.
Yeah.
But other than that, we've talked about the CGI, Jeff Bridges. I think there's a lack of motivation for the main villain, Clue. He wants to come into the human world and take over the whole planet. That doesn't make sense.
That's a shit motivation. Yeah.
Because the thing is, AI now, there is an element of the threat of AI. And the fact of an intelligent AI that doesn't like humans and wants to take over, I could see that playing out. I mean, that's basically the plot of the new Mission Impossible film. But coming in and kind of becoming the new kind of digital Hitler, it was just sort of like nobody who wrote this storyline has ever used a computer. Do you know what I mean? And then they haven't really sort of captured why digital beings are going to be able to obtain a physical form in the real world. We don't understand why Kevin Flint has been sitting there for 20 years and do nothing. They talk about he's not a program, he's a user, but they don't explain why that's a big deal. The gameplay hasn't moved on since the 80s. They don't have online links. Do you know what I mean? This isn't online. Why not? The gameplay hasn't moved on since the original film. The graphics are better, but still, people are still doing the equivalent of Space Invaders inside this virtual world.
Yeah, it did feel like the game was an abandoned, you know, arcade machine, mm-hmm. but the company had moved on. Do you know what I mean? It was very weird.
Yeah, they're just, they needed to do a lot more work on the story, because, like, I like the Michael Sheen character, but it's a shame that he's only in it for one scene, right? And they have this scene that Tron fights for the users. Why does Tron fight for the users? Why is that a big deal? Do you know what I mean? He says it, but I don't understand what any of it means. But, I mean, do you have any thoughts on remaking it? Because, I mean, I have some, but I wanted to give you the floor as well.
Yeah, I don't know. I think maybe the first mistake was bringing back Jeff Bridges in a way.
Hmm.
I think if they just tried a new story.
Certainly having him disappearing in like 4 years after the events of the first film, and it's been 20 or 5 years, and it's 20 years later, and he's just been sitting there doing nothing. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, as a gamer, I mean, you're more of a gamer than I am. I mean, what sort of you know, storylines or concepts or ideas would you want to see in a film where essentially that video game world has come to life, or you can be like transported into it? What sort of video game world could you see being interesting there?
It's quite hard because you have the popular games that are like, you know, Call of Duty and, you know, Fortnite and these kind of games, and FIFA is just playing, you know, football realistically, really. But games like Call of Duty are very much just kind of like first-person shooters, and Fortnite's like a battle royale. But the most, like, the games that always get celebrated at, you know, awards ceremonies are like role-playing games, and Tron isn't really that, I don't think. Just because the kind of basis of it was, you sort of like, you had the kind of bike kind of sequences, and, you know, other than that, you know, people go for the kind of role-playing games, you know, that the ones that always win are, you know, The Witcher 3,
yeah,
and God of War and Baldur's Gate just won recently, and these are all games that are like kind of big open fantasy worlds
or strong narratives like The Last of Us and stuff.
Yeah, things like that are the ones that are really popular. So it's hard to kind of see where they should go with it in terms of, you know, translating a video game story to the screen. I think the problem is, I think the kind of message at the start about making it a TV show is just the best way to do it. I've just finished watching the Fallout TV show first season. It was really good. But that's because they get to flesh it out over eight episodes. You can't do that in a film, but I don't think that many people give a shit about Tron, to be quite honest.
Yeah, and interestingly, I read a book by Christopher Brookmeyer, the Scottish author, who he likes his video games. He used to do sort of a certain kind of crime thriller, and the books he's written sort of, he's widened out and varied a little bit. And one of his books is about someone who gets kind of sucked into a video game world, but in a very, very different way. And he plays it out conceptually because he's a test candidate for the new technology. And they have lots of game worlds that they're testing out. And when he gets sucked into it, he's stuck in there and has to find his way out. And there's a few different twists and turns to that. And it's a lot more, it's a bit more conceptual about video games generally. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think that sort of thing would work. Now, but there are some ideas about the Tron mythology that I thought would work. So I had a couple of ideas. I thought it would work better if it's only been about 12 years since Flynn disappeared in the grid. Because you don't need a whole, you know, this kid's been a child, you know, been alone since he was 8, all of that stuff. I thought you could have a bit where he's been framed financial irregularities because someone in the company wanted him out. And his son's been locked out of the company due to lawsuits and financial blocks due to his dad being framed. And that's why he's hacking in, that's why he's fighting back. Alan Bradley, the other guy, he's never believed the allegations. He's been but he's sort of vaguely aware that something, you know, that Flynn might be out there. So he's like scouring the computer world. He's put a security back door in because he wants to see if Flynn is still trying to find his way back to the company. And when that page comes in to say, oh, the page has come from the arcade office and that's not been live for ages, I think Alan and Sam should go together, but Alan should be hit by the digital gun and disappear. And Sam doesn't know what to do, right? What the fuck's just happened, right? And then, but then Quora, the Olivia Wilde character, should appear as a hologram, you know, like something out of Red Dwarf, and tell him he's got to hack his way into the grid. Because if Sam's a hacker, let him hack. Let that be what he does in the story, right? So he then has to sneak onto an NCOM facility more quietly, hack in, and then you hear about the rebellion. And instead of it being like Jeff Bridges has been just living on his own for 20 years and all they do is play Space Invaders games, there's actually a whole live rebellion. And there's this talk about the Chosen One and she thinks it's Sam because he's like the son of Flynn and he's going to lead them, you know? And I think if you're going to have the Clue enemy character, maybe he looks like Jeff Bridges, but only from time to time. He's not just a copy of Jeff Bridges, but he can change his appearance. And that's how he tricks Sam at the beginning by pretending to look like Jeff Bridges, but not CGI Jeff Bridges. Jeff Bridges at his right age. And then he's got to rescue Alan. He's got to rescue his dad. There's a battle. Because what I did like in the story is you've got the people being picked up and like disposed of by the bad guys. Actually have a rebellion. Actually have people who are fighting against like the evil person who's taken over the AI. And I thought you could have something like maybe NCOM, the new board, the reason they got rid of Jeff Bridges' character is they want to exploit AI in an unethical way. And they're aware of this kind of virtual world and they want to take the AIs that have been created and put them in like, you know, bodies. So they're essentially AI bots that can walk around and do things. And that's Clue's plan. Because if they get taken out as AIs into the world, he can kind of infect them and cause mayhem, and AI can take over computer systems. I thought you could have more like live sort of battles like that, real world going on. And I think the reason Sam is of interest, yeah, as a user, is because he's a hacker. He's at the beginning of the film, right? Sam hacks into the system, shows like ability to get into a computer system no one else has, you know, makes the software available to the world. And then when he goes into the virtual world of Kevin Flynn, he's got no special skills. Do you know what I mean? So I want him to go into the world of Tron and have real special skills that make things happen. Maybe he can, because he's a hacker, he can conjure up a level of a video game. And all these people think they're clever with their light cycles. He calls up a level of Fortnite and you've got to fight your way out of Fortnite or whatever they invent. Do you know what I mean? And I think you could just be so much more inventive with the story. I think a live rebellion among them would be really good. And then what happens is the Olivia Wilde character, it should turn out that she's actually the chosen one. She's actually an AI that could be used for good. And if she gets out, instead of them just magically appearing, because at the end of Tron Legacy, the movie that they make, at the end of it, she magically comes out of the Tron world and she's a physical human. How the fuck does that happen? You know, what body does she occupy? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's but stupid.
But if the Encom like company has actually got these bodies ready to take AI implants into them, she could be taken into that, and that could be the job. Get her out, get her AI consciousness out of this world, because she could actually make things better. And when you know, and maybe Jeff Bridges has been in a coma for that time, rather than just sitting there doing nothing, and he's regretful for kind of letting the world get away from him, and you still have the father-son reconciliation thing. But I think you could just have a much more expanded and interesting world. I mean, would you watch that, or is it still more of a TV show for you than a movie?
Yeah, I think Tron might be fine as a film, like you've just said, because you could do that as a film. You don't need to flesh it out too much, but you just need to get the story right, and the story wasn't right for Tron Legacy, sorry. So I think... Yeah, I think definitely something a bit more interesting than what we got in the last one, or a bit more kind of explanation as yeah. to why you're doing those things.
Yeah, I mean, Michael Sheen is this kind of like shadowy character in and out of the rebellion. Don't know what side he's gonna take. Good and bad kind of computer systems inside the system fighting each other, and Sam has to kind of take a side, rescue his dad, relationship builds with Olivia Wilde. A little bit more going on with like the Encom outside world, because that actually worked quite well in the original Tron. Because in the original Tron, the villainous David Warner character, whose son is Cillian Murphy in this movie and they don't use, he's up to something. He's trying to cover up like the fact that he's embezzling funds from the company, and he's using the Tron system to try and cover his tracks. And I think that sort of like intrigue works a lot better. So I would have that. I think the fundamental problem with the original is it's an underdeveloped story. Some like mistakes about using CGI Jeff Bridges, and no one who's actually into games kind of imagining kind of what kind of video games people might be playing in 2010, rather than still being doing 1982 Tron light cycle stuff. But that's what yeah. I'd do with it. So going forward, we're going to give that a bit more prominent like place. We're going to sort of have a little remakes tribunal, and we can talk about whether our idea for remaking a film is going to get a green light, whether we'd agree with it. But yeah, it's always a nice thought experiment to do that remake. I think we would both like to have seen a better Tron movie than we saw there, right? Yeah,
definitely. Yeah.
What do you think of the new Tron Ares sequel that's getting talked about? Is that too little, too late? I mean, that's almost 15 years on now. Is that gonna?
I'll probably catch it on Disney Plus, but I'm not gonna read into it too much. I'll watch it. If it's shite, it's shite. Do you know what I mean?
I mean that sounds like it's going to be an invasion from the digital world to the human one, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And Ares was like the big kind of big bad or sort of big henchman in Tron Legacy, wasn't it? So that's going to be interesting to see what they do with it.
Yeah, we'll see.
It's directed by someone called Joachim Rønning, a Norwegian film director. And what else has he done? I'm clicking on his Wikipedia profile right now. Maleficent Mistress of Evil.
Nah, but it's going to be shite. Get it in the bin.
Oh, he co-directed Pirates of the Caribbean, Dead Men Tell No Tales with Espen Sandberg.
Fuck that.
I don't feel like that's going to have a particularly strong pedigree. What about Joseph Kosinski, though? I mean, what do you think of Joseph Kosinski, the film director?
Not too much. I've not really seen that much of his stuff.
Did you like Top Gun Maverick?
Yeah, but I don't think that was about the direction.
Yeah, that wasn't.
That was very much him. About the kind of technical side of it.
Yeah. Yeah, fair enough. Yeah, I quite like him, but again, I don't think he was integral, was he? If he'd been integral, he might have been able to influence Tron Legacy better. I think he was just a hired gun on that show. But there you go.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that's our remake restoration. Tell us what you think. Tell us if you'd watch that remake. Tell us if you think we've been unduly harsh on Orca and Killer Whale Judo. But yeah, thank you for listening through the features with us. That's all for this month's Double Reel Features. Thanks for listening. Thanks also to my co-host, James Adamson.
The music was Mistake the Getaway by Kevin MacLeod.
Ghost Dog The Way of the Samurai is available to rent or buy on digital platforms, and for the physical media hipsters as a brand new 4K Blu-ray.
The story of Martin Scorsese's House of Gucci was collected from various internet articles, and the book he was going to adapt is also available, Gucci, A House Divided by Gerald McKnight.
Tune in next week for the big conversation, where we'll be discussing our favourite films of the decade from 2000 to 2009.
We look forward to speaking to you then. Take care in the meantime.